Welcome to the Life Over Coffee podcast, conversations for transformation.
Hello, everyone. This is Rick Thomas. Thank you so much for joining me and Life Over Coffee, where we have conversations for transformation. Our mission statement is that we exist to bring hope and help to you and others by creating resources that spark conversations for transformation. And I trust that's what's going to happen as we spend the next few minutes together. The title of this presentation is Powerful and Practical Questions to Change Your Marriage. And so this is going to be an excellent presentation to help any couple who wants to do preventative maintenance on their marriage, or maybe their marriage is in a place where they need counseling help. Then this is going to be an outstanding resource for you. The big idea is that this lesson is a self-guided, self-paced counseling session for any couple who is serious about improving their marriage. I am going to work through a list of questions for you to respond to, and they are practical and potent, and they will lead the spouses into conversations for transformation. One of the number one requests that we get here at Life Over Coffee is for marriage counseling. We do not offer counseling because we are a leadership development site. We are a leadership development organization where we train people to do the work of discipleship and biblical counseling. And so we're teaching people how to do it. We are unable to be able to provide counseling for folks, but still people read our resources, listen to our podcast, watch our videos, and inevitably they will ask for counseling. And we're glad that they come to us, and we do try to direct them and give them the help that they need, even guiding them through the resources that we have at lifeovercoffee.com. But as I was thinking about these requests that continue to come in, I thought it would be an excellent idea to build a counseling session in a resource that any couple could take, a serious-minded couple who wants to improve their marriage. Most of the counseling that I do is marriage counseling, traditionally, historically, back when I was doing it on a daily and weekly basis, because it is the context of marriage where two sinful people have to live within proximity to each other for an extended period. Most of our relationships are temporary. I mean, even children, they have just a nanosecond that they spend in their homes. It may be 15, 18, 20 years, but eventually that ends. Marriage is unlike that. Marriage is an unending relationship until death, when the couple eventually parts. Even on social media, you can unfriend someone and move on to the next relationship. We know that inside our local churches, we split easy and we can go on to the next church. And so relationships are breakable, but the marriage covenant should not be. Now, I'm not recommending that you stay in a marriage when it is wise to leave. And of course, you've had community input that marriage has to cease. But it is within the marriage context where two sinful people are living together within proximity of each other for an extended period. And because of that, well, there can be problems. But what if a couple had a biblical strategy, creating a restorative pathway to bring hope and help to their covenant while staving off the worst possible scenario? Well, I trust that what I'm going to present to you would be that biblical strategy that can change your marriage. Now, it is possible that your mate, your spouse, is unwilling to work with you during this process. That happens so often within marriages. Everybody's at a different place in their sanctification. Some people are more mature, some are less mature. And then, of course, there are unequally yoked marriages where one person is a Christian and the other is not. So I know that everyone is not at the same place, and they are just super willing to get involved into marriage counseling counseling or to go through this resource that I'm presenting here. However, there are some things that you can do. And if you are the one that's working on your marriage alone, I will share some things with you that will help you as you move through this. And of course, I would appeal to you to continue to stay with what I'm presenting here, and you will find benefit personally. And ultimately, the hope and the prayer is that it will have some impact on your spouse as well. And so the question is, are you willing to fight for your marriage? Now, if both couples are willing or semi-willing to do that, then I challenge you to take these questions to heart. I have a lot of them, and I'm going to go slow. And I'll also provide you a resource at the end to where you can access every question that I am providing for you. And so don't worry, you'll be able to get all of the questions. But this here will be a flyby of sorts, because I want you to get all of the information, and then you can backtrack and go back through it and then work on the ones that apply to you. And if you're willing to fight for your marriage, then please take these questions to heart while seeking to apply them to your life practically. The key verse that I'm using for this presentation is James 4:17, as he puts his finger in our chest and he points to us and he says, "So whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin." And I think that is an appropriate verse for us, because if the Spirit of God is illuminating your mind and saying, "This is what you need to do," well, it will be sin if you do not do it. And I think that there are many instances in our lives where we know what we're supposed to do. We know the next right thing, this step that we should take. But because we don't share this with anyone, it's just between us and the Lord, and sometimes we can just dismiss the Lord out of our lives and go on with how we want to live. And so I trust that this verse will be a pointed one for some of us. If you know what to do and you fail to do it, then it will be sin. And what would happen at that point is there would be two sins in your life. Whatever is going on in the deterioration of your marriage, and then you knowing that this is what I'm supposed to do, but I'm not doing it, therefore that is the second sin. Well, we can avert all of this by saying, well, this is the time. Maybe my spouse is not interested or not as interested as I am. But as much as depends upon me, I'm going to do all that I can to cooperate with God in the restoration of our marriage. And so I know the right thing to do, or maybe you're at the juncture where you're unsure of the right thing to do. Well, I have an outline for you, and I trust that as you walk through these steps, you've already committed that you're going to do the right thing, and I trust this pathway will help you to stay that course. Let's look at the outline briefly. Number one, the process. I'll lay that out as for your counseling session. And again, think of this as a counseling session that you can go through over and over again. And there is a process for doing it. I'll lay that out for you. And then we will get into all of the questions. The first question set will be marriage assessment as you assess your marriage. Number three here is marriage and the Lord. Marriage and one flesh is number four. Number five, marriage and children. Number six, marriage and anger. Number seven, marriage and sex. And then finally, point number eight, ready, set, go. And then you can launch as you take all of these questions. You will tick the boxes of the ones that apply to you, and then that will be your counseling session that you will continue to work through this wonderful resource. Let's start with the process outline, point number one. There are six steps altogether. Step number one, what I want you to do is to go through all the questions before moving to the next step that I'm going to give you here. And so what I would like for you to do is to listen to this entire presentation. Just listen to it. Now, if you want, under each one of those categories there in the outline, like marriage assessment, marriage and the Lord, marriage one flesh, marriage and sex, marriage and children, and so forth, you can write those titles down on a piece of paper or on your device, and you can say question one, you know, or question five. And then that way you can remember, like, this is the one that the Spirit of God used. He was poking me in the chest, and this is a question that I need to deal with. And so, and you can do that, and then you can come back and then take your time to really be deliberate and work through those questions. And so the process, just listen to the presentation. Let's go through all the questions before we go step two. Then what I would like for you to do is to go through a second time, highlighting the ones the Spirit brings to your attention. Maybe you have already jotted some down as you go through this the first time. These are the ones that speak to how you need to change. And so you're going to do a flyby, go through the entire presentation, and then you're going to come back and you're really going to hunker down in the specific questions that apply to you. And then step number three, I want you to write those questions out on a piece of paper. And I do mean that. I want you to longhand write it out, because as you do that, you're starting to take ownership. We can read something and, you know, say, hey, that was nice, and maybe that's something I need to apply to my life. But when you put energy into actually reading it, and now I'm going to write it down on a piece of paper, you're moving it down into your long-term memory, and that is the process. That's what you want to do. Short-term memory is just reading something on a screen and moving to the next thing, and it will wash right out of your mind. But as you take your time and become deliberate, you read it, you write it down, you reflect upon it, you pray about it, you start writing out action steps, then you're taking ownership. And this is one of the reasons that many people do not change. It's because they move too quickly. Step number three, write it out on a piece of paper. Number four, ask God about how you need to change as you reflect on the questions that apply to you. Can you see how it's sinking down into your psyche, into your soul? Going from short-term memory to long-term memory, you read it, you wrote it out, now you are praying about it. Step number five, write specific and practical action points, things you can immediately implement into your life. And then step number six, share your conclusions and your solutions with a friend, asking them to help you fulfill what the Spirit is leading you to do. I really want you to see what steps two through six are, sinking into your psyche so that you can own this information, so eventually it owns you and it becomes part of your habitualization. It becomes part of your habit, part of your lifestyle. You are putting off the old person, renewing the mind, and putting on a new person that looks like Christ. And if you work through this process, it can happen to you. All right, let's get into the questions in the outline, point number two. The first set question set is marriage assessment. I will begin each one with a quote you see here on the screen. The husband and wife are a picture of Christ and the church. When people see a Christian couple, they gain ideas about what Christ and the church look like. Their marriage is four things, at least. One, a sweet savor to God, that is the vertical. A blessing to each other, that's the home. A testimony to the redeemed, their church family and other believers, as that marriage, the concentric circles continue to move out from the home. And a picture of hope for a church that has no hope. And so you could look at your marriage as four concentric circles. In the very middle is the sweet savor to God. And then moving out, it's a blessing to each other, a testimony to the redeemed, and a picture of hope for a culture that has no hope. So when people see you, husband and wife, they see a picture of Christ and the church. Now the question is, what does that look like to them? Or more pointedly, what do you look like to them? And that's what this marriage assessment hopefully will help you to analyze as we work through these diagnostic questions. Question number one, when was the last time you got away with your spouse to talk about your marriage? Make plans now for your next date night or mini getaway. Now, it doesn't matter what you call it. The key idea here is koinonia, or communication. The question that I'm asking is, are you regularly communicating with your spouse? Now, you don't need a date night to do that. You don't need a legalistic date night. Every Friday night at 7 o'clock, this is what we do. That's fine if that is your habit, but you want to make sure that we're not just ticking a box. I know sometimes within Christianity, our disciplines can become rote habits that lose their meaning, much like the Pharisees in the New Testament, who had the shell and the framework of religion, but they did not have the heart of religion, as Jesus was saying in Matthew 23. And so I'm using words like date night or mini getaway, but there has to be intentionality inserted of whatever these contexts are in which you communicate or have koinonia with your spouse. It could be a daily habit of yours. It could be at dinner time. It could be at night just before bed. It could be in the morning if you do devotions together. You don't have to do devotions together, but many couples do. But what is the context? And then inside of that context, are you regularly getting away with your spouse to talk about your marriage? Now, there should be a rhythm to this. There should be beats that you should be hitting in a consistent pattern. And I'm not talking about once a year for like a mini getaway. It needs to be more regular than that. If you're not talking at least weekly, daily is better, even in these little 5-minute talks as you intersect in the kitchen or wherever you may be. Just having one data point where you're talking about something that pertains to your marriage. But there needs to be a dedicated time. A date night could be excellent for that, where you sit down and you talk to each other in an undistracted way with no devices between each other. Now, perhaps a question that you could ask, this is something that we have asked for decades now. One of our primary questions is, how can I serve you? Or how can I be a better husband? Or she might ask, how can I be a better wife? Asking pointed questions that really get to the heart of the state of your marriage. Question number 2, is your marriage moving toward oneness or drifting toward isolation? Why? What are you doing to move it toward oneness? No marriage is static. We're always moving in one direction or the other. Think about the dating relationship. When you first met, you obviously were moving toward each other. You were magnetic. You couldn't stay away from each other. You created time to be with each other, perhaps talk late into the evening and early hours of the morning on the phone, texting one another. For those of you who started dating during the age of technology, we did not do that. For those of you who are older like me, perhaps writing letters to each other, but you found ways to move toward each other in closeness. What happens after marriage? This gets back to the proximity, living within proximity of each other for an extended period, as I talked about earlier. Well, sin happens. Now there are no breaks. There are no extended times away to where you can catch your breath and just get away from each other. And sin happens, and there's no getting away from each other. And many couples do not have a sin plan, meaning that they do not have a way of dealing with sin. They have no sin toolbox when sin happens. When your washing machine breaks down, your refrigerator breaks down, when your lawnmower breaks down, you have tools. You go to the garage, you go to the basement, you go to where your toolbox is, or you take these appliances to someone. You have a plan for repairing them. Unfortunately, we don't have a plan for repairing our marriages. Too many marriages do not, is what I meant. And so the question is, are you moving toward oneness or drifting toward isolation? You are moving one way or the other. And of course, where it will really become acute is if you have children and then you're in the empty nesting stage, because children can be distractions during marriage as well as work. And then when the spouses retire from their work or children move out of the home and they have virtually unlimited time together, then all the things that they've never dealt with during the years of or the decades of distraction are now front and center, and they can really be acute, never even realizing the slow drift that was on in the relationship. Question number three. Do you typically not acknowledge your spouse's strengths, weaknesses, or neither? So this is a question about how you think about the good things your spouse does, strengths, bad things your spouse does. Do you talk about them, either one, both of them, neither of them? And then, of course, you want to insert here, how do you talk about your spouse's strengths and weaknesses if you do? I would imagine that in a normal situation, and I would put air quotes over normal, around normal, we would thank them for their strengths and probably criticize them for their weaknesses. And that would be problematic within a marriage. When I say normal, I'm talking about Adamic normal, our native selves, not our Christocentric selves, our regenerate selves. And so this is something that you really want to have a discussion with your spouse. It's like, well, you never acknowledge me, anything that I ever do good, or maybe you do, and that's a good thing. Or perhaps you're very critical about when they make a mistake or do not meet your expectations, etc. But this is a talking point, and it may be surprising to some at how this is such a source of irritation and ongoing frustration within the marriage that can lead to a lot of anger, which I will talk about later. Number four, do you believe you are the most selfish person you know? If you answer no to this question, then why? Now, this question is tied to what Paul was saying in 1 Timothy 1:15, that he was the foremost sinner, the chief of sinner. Now, if we are spending time with the Lord in a consistent basis, then we have to know that we're the most selfish person that we know, because we spend more time with God confessing our sins, asking Him to change us, change our thought life, change our motives, deconstruct or break down the idols of our heart, help us to mature in Christ, help us to desire this sincere milk of the Word. Dear Lord, change me. I mean, spending time with the Lord is not a negative exercise or a negative opportunity, but when you do that, I mean, that's why we spend time with the Lord, because we are optimistic, we are confident, we draw near to Him with confidence. We know that we have a Savior and He can change us. But there's a proportionality here that if you spend time with the Lord, then there is a heightened awareness of how selfish you are. And then if you don't think you're the most selfish person that you know, then I would wonder how much time you're spending with the Lord, how much time you're spending asking God to change you, because you know more about yourself than you know about anybody. You know everyone else externally. You know everyone else from what you have observed or how you have interacted with them. You know all that about yourself, but you also know your thought life. You know the motivations of your heart. You know those secret things that nobody else knows. And so if you answer this question that, no, I'm not the most selfish person that I know, well, then that is a reflection of your time with the Lord or the lack thereof, or how you communicate with the Lord and how transparent and open and honest you are with Him. Do you believe you're the most selfish person that you know? If you answer no to this question, then that needs to be a talking point with your spouse. Perhaps you want to talk to the Lord about that first. Question number five. Are you generally quick to speak and slow to listen? You know this is coming out of James's playbook in chapter number one. Or are you quick to listen and slow to speak, which is what James would ask us to be? Please explain your answer. Also, if you need to change, what is your plan? Now, I'm going through these questions somewhat quickly. As I said earlier, you could title your page if you're keeping notes, marriage assessment for this point on the outline. And you could talk, you could just put a number, one or two or three or four or five or all five. I need to deal with all five of these. And then you can come back later and find them. I'll show you how to do that. And then you can spend quality time with each one of these questions. So don't be concerned about the speed in which I'm presenting this to you. Number six, what does your spouse do well? What do you need to work on to change you? Now, here's an excellent life project. I would appeal to you to make two lists. One list for what your spouse does well, and the other for what you need to work on to improve yourself. Now, if you could suspend imagination for just a moment and maybe even suspend reality and think about any marriage, imagine if two spouses actually did this. Where both spouses that have two lists, and the husband would make a list of all the things that his wife does well and all the things he needs to improve on, and his wife did the same. This right here, question number six, would absolutely transform a marriage. Pray through both lists, thanking God for what your spouse does well and asking God to change you in areas that need improvement. I would encourage you also to make a note here, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 1 through 9. And you will read in those nine verses Paul's gratitude, his thanksgiving, his appreciation for those mean Corinthians. And so he was interacting with some difficult people. But you hear Paul's attitude in those first nine verses. He had a list. He gives you a list in chapter 1, the first nine verses, of the things that they are doing well. Now, it's important to understand that he did not withhold correction, but there's also a sequence there. The people that you correct, they need to know that you are for them, that you love them, that you recognize that they're doing some things well. And so we always want to be grateful for people, even or especially those whom we correct. You can think about children, for example. If you're always nitpicking, nagging, criticizing, condemning children, but you never acknowledge anything that they ever do well, you will exasperate them. And when their time comes to leave the home, they will leave quickly. And they will leave with relief because they've got out from under all of that criticism and condemnation. So again, you don't withhold correction, but there is a way of doing it. And being grateful for the things that they do well is essential, as Paul was with the Corinthians. Marriage assessment, the final question, number seven, do you accept and affirm your spouse when they? And I'm going to give you some options here to choose from. And so the idea, do you accept and affirm your spouse when they, number one, meet your expectations, number two, do not meet your expectations, number three, I accept and affirm them both, one and two, when they meet my expectations and when they don't, I accept and affirm them, number four, none of the above. And then the question, what do you need to change? Now, this is an important question, and what happens too often is that we have expectations for people, which is fine, but expectations will always fail in meeting our expectations, meaning that we will not meet someone's expectations 10 times out of 10. It just won't happen. And if we're not careful, we won't hear ourselves talking. We won't hear ourselves responding to someone who did not meet our expectations. And without a lack of carefulness, we can become critical. And what will happen is that there's a lot of things that can happen, but one of those things is that they will be inhibited from trying to do something again for you because they know they're going to get fussed at. They know they're going to get a negative response because they did not get it right. And so it will create a pause in their soul. Now, there's many other things that will start breaking down in the relationship. If the only time that I affirm you, accept you, is when you make me happy, and you can see the self-centeredness in that statement, there's a lot here. And so if this is a part of what is going not so swell in your marriage, I would encourage you to spend a lot of time thinking through this question here. Number 7, under marriage assessment. In the outline, point number 3, marriage and the Lord, the quote, "The Bible's message is to help us become better people, redeemed. Can we trust God's word to do the same in our marriages? God did not offer us salvation so we would not experience any more trouble. We know that God uses sin sinlessly, and he will bring things in our life. Paul, it was a thorn in the flesh. Joseph, well, we know about his trouble in Genesis chapter 37 through 15. And God will save us, but he will not keep us from trouble. He provides salvation to give us hope and help during our trials and a home in heaven. Our relationship with God and our spouses is similar. And so our spouses are an opportunity for us to mature in the Lord. God gives us a unique spouse, not to hurt us, to hinder us, but just like he brings other things in our lives, all things come into our lives for his glory, his fame, for our good, for us to learn perseverance, to grow in character, to mature in Christ's likeness. And so he uses our spouse to help us to be more conformed to the image of Jesus Christ. And so with marriage and the Lord as the category, question number 1, what have you drifted from or forgotten about regarding your marriage that you need to get back to in your relationship? And perhaps you can think of the dating relationship and how it used to be. You know, you opened the car door, you sent, you gave her flowers, or she wrote little notes. And I'm not necessarily saying that you have to go back and do all of those things, those mechanical things. Those are things that were born out of a heart of love. But our love has matured. And so the concept here is that it is an ever-maturing love. And so we may not be giving flowers like we did when we were dating and all the other things, going through all the drive-thrus and eating the way we did when we were much younger. But our love should mature. And so the big idea here is that have we drifted from that first love is the question. And if we have drifted from that first love, then, well, we need to ask God to do a work in our hearts. The things that we do for our spouses, again, they will be much different 10, 15, 20, 30, 35, 40 years later, but it will be out of a heart of love. And that should be the trend line that moves from whether it's dating and the silliness of our dating relationship to a deep-seated maturity 40 years later. We want to make sure that we haven't drifted from the love that we have for each other. Number 2, do you see your marriage troubles as opportunities to trust God while working through difficulties? Meaning, do you see the heat, the trouble in your life? And again, we should see all trouble in our life as an opportunity to trust God. God does not bring trouble, permit trouble into our lives without a redemptive possibility. What does it mean to find strength through weakness? And why would God bring you to a place of weakness so that you can experience his strength? We're talking about 2 Corinthians here, chapter 12 specifically. God brought a thorn in Paul's flesh. I am not saying that your spouse is a thorn in the flesh, but I am saying that there is a truth there, and we learn it. Paul's very clear about it as he asked God to take that thorn away. And the Lord said, no, my strength is perfected in your weakness. And of course, Paul would go on to say that he would rejoice in his infirmities and in his affliction and in his persecution, etc. And then he would tell us that when he is weak, then he is strong. And so the question is, do you see your marriage troubles as opportunities to trust God while working through difficulties? What does it mean to find strength through weakness? And why would God bring you to a place of weakness so that you can experience strength? I trust you can answer that question. And then finally, in this question set, how do you need to change in light of these things? Number 3, are you a Christian? The category here is marriage and the Lord. Are you a Christian? Maybe the impulse answer is, yes, I am, and that's fine. I trust that is true. Ask your spouse to share with you their reasons why they believe that you are a Christian. If you are a Christian, then you will ask this question. This is an easy question to ask because you are a Christian. If there is tentativeness or inhibition about asking this question, then those are signs that you do need to address. Your spouse should be able to tell you that I believe that you are a Christian, and here's some of the reasons why. By the way, this is an excellent diagnostic question in marriage counseling. I have asked it many times because the impulse, again, can be, if you ask a spouse, is your spouse a Christian? Many times they will just quickly say, yes. And then there has to be a follow-up. And sometimes I will say it like this. What if Jesus Christ was sitting to your right and you turn to him and you make a case to Christ for your spouse, convincing Christ, telling Christ why you know without any question that your spouse is a Christian. Now, here's all the reasons why. And there have been many times where the spouse that I was talking to paused. And it's several times they have come back and said, well, I'm not exactly sure. And what happens if you're in a Christianized region of the world, or you live within a Christianized community, a Christian community, but you're Christianized in a Christian community? We can take on the persona of a Christian, but it not be real. And one of the ways that you'll find out if our Christianity is genuine is going back to question number two here on the screen, that finding strength through our weakness. Suffering will reveal to you the quality of your faith, or whether it exists at all. And so God will bring persecution into our lives to bring us to a place of weakness. And maybe that place of weakness is the realization that you're not a Christian at all. That's the lowest level of weakness that you can come to, is recognizing that I am sick, I am broken, I'm worse off than I ever imagined, and I need a Savior. Or it could be that you are a Christian, but a very self-reliant one, that you do not trust God. And so the Lord will bring us to places of weakness to where we cannot fix the situation. We cannot rely on ourselves. And through that weakness, we find his strength perfected in us. And so the question is, are you a Christian? Ask your spouse to share with you their reasons why they believe you are. Question number four, what are the similarities between your relationship with God and your spouse? We are to love God and love others. Those are the two great commandments, as we read in Matthew 22. And so we should be treating God the way we treat our spouse, or treat our spouse the way we treat the Lord. Meaning we love God. Well, we should be loving our spouses. How can one say that? I mean, this is what James was saying in James chapter 3, verses 9 and 10. Out of the same mouth come blessing and cursing. We bless God the Father, but we curse man who's made in the similitude, or made in the imago Dei, made in the image of God. My brothers, James says, this thing ought not to be. And so we love God and we should love others. And so there should be a similarity between our relationship with God and our spouse. Our spouse is the closest human to us. And if there's discontinuity between the way we say we love God and the way we act out loving our spouse, then there is something really wrong with our religion. And maybe we need to go back to question number three. Are you a Christian? And so I have some things on the screen here. Do you love God? You should love your spouse. How can you say that I love God and hate my brother? Do you have affection for God? Do you have affection for your spouse? Are you impatient with God? Are you impatient with your spouse? I'm using some negative words here as well. Anger. Are you angry at your spouse? Well, are you angry at God? Is there inconsistency here? And by the way, there is a subtle anger at God if you are angry at your spouse, because ultimately God is sovereign and he rules, and he brought your spouse to you. And to hate the gift that he brought to you is to hate the giver of the gift, even though many people do not see their anger toward their spouse as ultimately this subtle, unmentioned anger toward God. Do you treat your spouse the way you think about and treat God? That is question number four. The outline, now we're at point number four, marriage and one flesh. Beware of overdependence on your parents. We're talking about a one flesh union here, a covenant between a man and a woman. Cut the unbiblical cord. It is not biblical to stay dependent on dad and mom after marriage. This is a thing with too many marriages where the husband or the wife, they don't leave. They leave physically, geographically, but there's still a dependency. They have not cut the unbiblical cord. Keep honoring your parents. Yes, by all means, it's one of the great Ten Commandments. You want to honor them. Sometimes honoring them is doing hard things for them. To love somebody well, sometimes you have to correct them. And so we want to ensure that we don't define honoring as giving them everything that they want. That's not honoring them. That is enabling them. And so, yeah, keep honoring them in the fullest understanding of what the word honoring can mean, but you need to leave. We must choose to receive our spouse as God's perfect provision for us. So we're talking about marriage and one flesh is the category. The question is, number one, what does honor parents look like after you leave the home? What should it not look like in your marriage? What areas do you need to change? I've already spoken to this with the quote, and I would just appeal to you to think about a comprehensive understanding of what honoring means. Honoring, obviously, it means loving them, respecting them, having affection for them. But it could be setting parameters. Loving them so much that you help them to see what maybe they don't see. Maybe they have a dependency on their children. Maybe their marriage is not what it should be, and they don't want the children to go because they don't want to live with their spouse. And so they have this dependency on their children or their grandchildren, and they're using the children and grandchildren. I'm just giving you one illustration here. Using them as idols to bring comfort, to bring a distraction in their life because their marriage is not what it should be. And so again, my point here is that honoring can be a very positive thing, but sometimes there's a negative side to honoring, but it's very biblical when we step in and do the right thing to help them to mature toward God. Number two, what does it mean to you to cleave to one another? How has it worked out in your marriage? What is great? What needs to change, if anything? Now, this can also happen seasonally in a marriage. In the early season of marriage, where you just left the home, your respective homes, there is still that unbiblical cord is still there. And there's some things that you have to evolve into. And you need to have those discussions. If you've been married for 6 weeks, 6 months, 6 years, and there's still an attachment to the home that's not to your where you're reared, and it's not what it should be, you need to have those conversations. And what you may find is that as the marriage matures and the season moves along, and now you've been married 10 to 15 years, those things, they should go away naturally. But you have to talk about them. Question number three, when was the last time you thanked God for your spouse? When was the last time your spouse heard you thank God for them? Now, the reason that question is here is for two. One, you're one flesh. And so you're thanking God for your arm, your leg, your head, your shoulder. You're thanking God for your body. You're one flesh. You don't hate your body. Paul talked about this. You nourish and cherish your body. And so there should be automatic gratitude that flows out of our mouths for our body, for our one flesh union. But then also, the second part here is that your spouse is numero uno, number one, not your parents, his parents, her parents. So in the context of this one flesh union, I've been talking about honoring parents. And so there's a part of that too, that the spouse is number one, not the parents. And then, of course, the other aspect of thanking God for your spouse is because you are one flesh, and there is something malignant. There's something wrong with your body if you're not thanking God for it. If you are angry at it, if you have any kind of division in that one flesh union, there cannot be a hairline fracture in the body of Christ, but also in your marriage. Question number four. Weaknesses are not justification to reject your spouse. Do you see your spouse as a gift from God? The way Adam and Eve, the way Adam saw Eve, when Adam first saw Eve, he says, "At last." I love that. "Bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. She should be called a woman because she was taken out of my body." How do your spouse's weaknesses mature you? If their weaknesses weaken you, what's wrong with you? If God brings heat into your life, brings challenges in your life, and it weakens you, frustrates you, makes you angry, well, then your spouse is an instrument of righteousness in God's hands that He is using to identify things that you need to address in your heart. Why do their weaknesses have so much power over you? Now, this is a complex, multi-layered question, and many of you maybe need to spend some time with it. Number one, weaknesses are not justification to reject your spouse. I mean, because my hand will not perform the way other people's hand performs, I'm just going to cut it off. Well, that makes no sense. Do you see your spouse as a gift from God, the way Adam saw Eve? How do your spouse's weaknesses mature you? That should be the natural byproduct of weaknesses, is that it should mature us. And if their weaknesses weaken us, then we're not able to come alongside them and to help them mature. It's more about us and what we're not getting and what they're doing to us, rather than an opportunity to come alongside them to complete them. In a one-flesh marriage, there are both strengths and weaknesses. They fit like two gears meshing together. And your strengths should make your spouse complete, and their strengths should make your weaknesses complete. Why do their weaknesses have so much power over you? Number five, what are some of your weaknesses that your spouse fills so well? They fill in so well. This is the complete thing I was talking about earlier, that you have inconsistencies, that you have weaknesses, that you're not perfectly rounded. You have a missing piece. You're not omnipotent. You're not omniscient. You're not omnipresent. You don't have incommunicable attributes from the Lord. We're fallen, frail people, born in Adam, born in the Imago Dei. Praise God. We're made in the image of God, but we have imputed sin. And so there are things that are wrong with us and our spouses. They come alongside us and they feel us. Adam was missing a piece. He was missing a part of his flesh, and Eve filled him so perfectly. Thank God for your spouse's completion of you. And so it would be good to identify some of the weaknesses that you have and how your spouse fills them in so well. Number six, how do you communicate to your spouse that they are a gift from God? I was saying earlier about gratitude. I've said that a couple of times already, and this is another opportunity to communicate to your spouse that they are a gift from God. I would ask you to be practical in your thoughts and communication. And maybe this is the time to stop the tape, so to speak, and do it right now. And say, thank you. And be practical. How do they do this? What are some of the ways that you recognize that they are a gift that God has given you? By the way, there is a reciprocal benefit to this. I mean, just as there is with nagging and criticism, if you nag and criticize your spouse, there will be reciprocal not benefits. There will be liabilities. There will be adverse reactions. But when we encourage one another, not that your motive is to benefit from your encouragement, but there's a natural byproduct of encouragement, that they will be encouraged and it will be reciprocating to you. You will benefit from it. Be practical in your thoughts and communication. Outline number five, we're at marriage and children. When a child knows that you love your spouse more than you love them, they feel safe because they sense the unity between their parents. your kids are not listening to you as much as they are absorbing you. It's kind of like loud noise. I don't know if you probably have. I would imagine you've been in a place where things were just very loud and it's so distracting. You are absorbing the vibrations and the noise. Kids are absorbing parents. For good or bad, whatever's going on, they are absorbing. Your modeling speaks louder than your words. Your number one responsibility as parents is to become the people that you want your kids to be. There's several parts of this quote here. I'll just hit them briefly. When a child knows that you love your spouse more than you love them, they feel safe because they sense the unity between their parents. And what I mean by this sentence here, that you love them more, maybe you want to use the word differently, that you love them differently. I don't necessarily rank I love you more than the other. You know, it's like three kids asking you, which one of us you love more? That's not the right question. You love them differently. But the point here is that there is no question that you love your spouse. It's kind of what Jesus was talking about in Luke 14. If you do not hate your father and your mother and your brother and sister and your own life also, you cannot be my disciple. And so he was using hyperbolic language. I'm kind of doing that here. And what he's saying here, that it's so evident that you love God that all other loves look like hate in comparison, using that hyperbolic speech. And so that should be evident with your children because they will absorb you. And if you are critical or disrespect your spouse, they will absorb that and it will have an impact on their lives. And so you will not be modeling. You'll be saying things with your mouth. You'll be teaching them with your words, but your lifestyle, what they are absorbing, the way that you treat your spouse, it will not turn out well for you. You will impact them adversely. That will be a negative shaping influence in their life. Your number one responsibility as parents is to become the people that you want your kids to be. And so if you want them to be righteous, be righteous. If you want them to respect others, respect your spouse, etc. Marriage and children is the category. Question number one, do you love God more than anyone else? Do you love your spouse more than your children? Now, again, I explain what I mean by that, so I'll not repeat that. But the answer to both questions should be a resounding yes. If not, why not? Again, they should sense it, like what Jesus was saying in Luke 14. They should feel it, that, wow, my dad loves God and loves mom, like, profoundly. Or my mom loves God and loves dad profoundly. Man, when they feel that, sense that, know that, see that, absorb that, it will bring security. It will just have an incredible impact on their little souls. Question number two, what are you modeling to your children that you need to change? What are you imitating? Follow me as I follow Christ. Is that what's happening? Are you imitating God? As Paul said in Ephesians 5. Perhaps you can ask your spouse for suggestions. Maybe that would benefit to have that conversation. The modeling of the gospel must precede the teaching of the gospel. Number three, when was the last time your children heard you thank God for your spouse? What do you need to do to be more verbal about your affection for your spouse? How would your children describe your affection for your spouse, assuming they're old enough to understand the question? Now, if they're old enough, this could be an excellent leadership opportunity for you to ask that question. Hey, as you observe my life, specifically my relationship with my spouse, the other parent in the home, describe how you believe my affection is for my spouse. Do I love my spouse? What is your opinion? That would be an excellent question for you to ask. If you can't ask this question or you're unwilling to ask the question, then you probably have the answer. And I would suggest under this category, marriage and children, that you highlight point number three, because that is something that you would need to work on. Marriage and anger, the category number six in the outline. The goal regarding conflict is not to be conflict-free, because that is impossible. Two sinners living in proximity to each other until death do they part. And so the goal is not to be conflict-free. If you try to be conflict-free, you're going to create more conflict. The goal is to resolve disputes biblically. The most unresolved conflict has more to do with a lack of forgiveness than a lack of asking for forgiveness. And what I mean by that is that we can ask for forgiveness, And we have a lot of teaching at Life Over Coffee about forgiveness and unforgiveness. And I would encourage you, if you want to do a deeper dive in it, to please do that, because this is a huge area in marriages and in all relationships. And the statement is, we can ask for forgiveness and go away from each other, but the conflict is not resolved. The most unresolved conflict has more to do with a lack of unforgiveness than a lack of asking, because our asking is not potent. Our asking does not have the efficacious, redemptive, transformative necessities to it. Conflict is a hurt that can go away. Unforgiveness is a hurt that will never go away. And this is one of the biggest things that I see with couples, unforgiveness. And many times they will say, well, I asked for forgiveness. You know, I said I forgave her, but it's just not true. Marriage and anger is the category. Question number one. Are you surprised that you do not always get along with your spouse? Now, if you are surprised that you do not always get along with your spouse, then, well, I would just encourage you to do a study in anthropology, the doctrine of humanity, hermeneutology, the doctrine of sin, and recognize that we live in a fallen world. If we are surprised when our spouses or anyone else's sin, that's actually what we do. We are professionals. We're professional sinners. We do it well. We do it all the time. They do not need our surprise. They need our redemptive care. What things do you need to change to seek resolution? When you're surprised that you do not always get along with your spouse, I trust you have a sin plan, that you have redemptive solutions in your toolbox. Number two, are there any unresolved issues in your marriage that you have not forgiven your spouse? What does it mean to overlook an offense? How are you doing with transacting forgiveness? What about overlooking that which you should? Sometimes we can overlook some things. We do not want to, like nickel and dime, exasperate a person, but always bringing up their offenses. There are some things we can overlook. There's other things that we need to transact where we ask, will you forgive me? Number three, will you talk with your spouse about the hurt behind your anger? Again, we're talking about marriage and anger. One of the most common things that happen in marriages is anger. Of course, anger is a behavioral manifestation that people experience, but underneath it is a hurt, and you'll find underneath that hurt is unforgiveness, unresolved conflict. Number four, what hurt are you unwilling to grant true biblical forgiveness? You're just going to hold on to it. Will you seek reconciliation today? Number seven, marriage and sex. Which one of these is most true? If you want a great sex life, work on your relationship. Is that most true? Or if you want a great relationship, work on your sex life. Sex is the crossroads of your life. All areas of personal difficulty tend to intersect in a person's sex life. Marriage and sex, question number one. I didn't give the answer to the question in that quote. I want you to spend some time thinking about it and come to the answer yourself. Question one, what areas of your outside-the-bedroom sex life do you need to address? If you want to know if a person, if a couple is getting along well, then you start talking about their sex life, because their sex life will point to an outside-the-bedroom problems that they have not resolved. Which leads to question number two, what past unresolved sin issues are impacting your sex life? Question number three, what needs to happen for you to be other-centered in your intimate relationship with your spouse? Now, we have a lot of resources at Life Over Coffee on marriage and sex, physical intimacy. I would encourage you to check them out, because I know that this is a huge problem with so many people. This is why I would ask you to return to this part of the presentation. And if these three questions need to be worked through, I would encourage you to do it, because I'm moving rapidly through this. I recognize that. But I want to honor your time. But because this is recorded, you can go back and go through it many, many times in the future. Describe your sexual relationship. Question number four is the final question. Number eight, ready, set, and go. What you have just received here is the equivalent of multiple marriage counseling sessions. Take your time as you review and select the questions that apply to you and your marriage. Perhaps your spouse is unwilling to work with you on your marriage, and if that is the case, I encourage you to talk to a leader in your church, appealing to them to find someone of the same gender with whom you can speak about these things in an ongoing way, where you can talk about these questions, where they will hold you accountable for you, doing all that depends upon you to change yourself. Please talk to that leader as soon as possible. They are welcome to watch this presentation too. Before we leave, I do want to give you a link to where you can find what I just presented to you, but also want to ask you to pray for our ministry. Follow us on socials, share our resources, and for those of you who are able to invest in what we're doing, then please, if you can support or donate, we need it in order to produce these resources that we give so many of our resources away, and we cannot do that without your support. Also, we have an all-online training program where we teach Christians to do biblical counseling, to do discipleship. It's self-paced, 100% online. That information is at lifeovercoffee.com, and so if you're interested in becoming a mastermind student or at least looking into it, please do that. We talked about the process, laid it out. There is marriage assessment, marriage and the Lord, marriage in one flesh, marriage and children, marriage and anger, marriage and sex, and now we are ready to go. As James says, whosoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. This lesson is a self-guided, self-paced counseling session for any couple who is serious about improving their marriage. The questions are practical and potent. They will lead the spouses into conversations for transformation. I've titled it Powerful and Practical Questions to Change Your Marriage. Please go for a full transcript and a podcast also of this session, the video as well. All the questions, go to lifeovercoffee.com. You see the link here on the screen, or search Powerful and Practical Questions to Change Your Marriage. If you type some version of that into Life Over Coffee, probably Powerful and Practical Questions, that will get you to where you need to go, and you can find all of these questions, a video, and a podcast. Thank you so much for watching this presentation. My name is Rick Thomas. You can find me at Life Over Coffee, where we have conversations for transformation.
Thanks for joining us. Learn more and get access to other resources at lifeovercoffee.com.